You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
March, candy one, candy one. Many stones can form an arch. Singly done, singly done. And by union, what we will can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill. Singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124. Since 1983, Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish Law Firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at bktplaw.com to contact us for a free consultation. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124, supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905, and if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. In the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, in January 1990, a gang of thugs invaded a Ford assembly plant in Mexico City and opened fire on the workers, killing one and injuring several. The workers were trying to win an independent union. Who hired and paid the assassins? What did it have to do with the AFL-CIO and the CIA? And how it set back unionism in Mexico for 30 years, holding wages down to a few dollars a day? This is the subject of tonight's show. We'll talk to the author, Rob McKenzie, of a new book trying to answer these questions. In the news, the painters have a contract ending their strike, and independent Starbucks baristas are calling on you to come sip in. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Michael Amish. It's on captive audience meetings. And now for the news.
From our side.
This is the news from our side, April 14th, 2022. Earlier this month, the National Labor Relations Board issued a press release reporting that union organizing is on the upsurge. So are charges of unfair labor practices against employers. During the first 6 months of fiscal 2022, which is October 1st to March 31st, union representation petitions filed at the NLRB have increased 57% to 1,174. At the same time, unfair labor practice charges have increased 14% to 8,254. The board is woefully underfunded to handle this surge, which means delays in representation elections and resolution of complaints against employers or unions will be longer. There's been no increase in funding for the last 9 years, and when inflation is taken into consideration, they are operating at 25% less than they did in 2010, with 50% fewer field staff than 20 years ago. Even President Biden's budget for 2023 won't allow for full staffing.
Perhaps that's why it's taking so long for workers at the area's Starbucks stores to get representation elections. So far, four area stores have filed for NLRB representation elections. Only one has had one. That's the one in Overland Park, which has a provisional win depending on some challenged ballots. It appears from NLRB records that unfair labor practices charges have been filed by employees at one of the two stores in the Midtown area that have filed for representation elections. There's one in the plaza and another right down Main Street from here at KKFI. Both of them have filed for an election. At the Main Street Starbucks, an employee told KCUR in late March, "We will not let our company hide behind budgets and false platitudes when we ask for sanitation and protections from the literal pandemic that has nearly killed 1 million Americans to this day. We have endured uncertainty, hardship, and constant setbacks, yet we remain. We choose to stay because we all believed in the partner promise and for our customers for whom we endure the grind every day." The fourth area Starbucks that's organizing is in Independence, across from the mall. Those workers have come up with a novel tactic to pressure for recognition. It's a solidarity sip-in. It will take place next Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 18710 East 39th Street South. The workers are asking sippers to order a drink under the name of Union Strong or Union Yes, and take a seat and sip, while you show your barista some solidarity. The Heartland Labor Forum will be there, as will Missouri Jobs with Justice. Will you?
Last week, we reported that the painters and finishers in Kansas City, members of Painters Local 2012, who went on strike early last Tuesday morning, had a settlement, which they would vote on Friday, the day after our report. The workers rejected the settlement overwhelmingly and hit the picket lines again. The issue was wages. This time, the union decided to divide and conquer and negotiated interim agreements with a few contractors in the association of contractors with whom the painters bargain. The interim agreement would only take effect if the rest of the employers also agreed. That split them, and they began to fall in line one by one. According to Painters District Council spokesperson Jessica Padola, the employers and the union were 30 to 40 cents an hour apart, but before this tactic, they had only moved about 4 cents in a week. After the union signed interim agreements with two of the 96 contractors, they increased their offer to 35 cents an hour increase for the different job classifications. She said it helps that they had 600 workers on strike, and they totally shut down work at about five big projects around town, including at Lockton and Garmin. The solidarity of other trades who sacrificed several days' pay made a huge difference. So did a new communications app, which allowed the union to give updates to most of the strikers on a minute-by-minute basis.
As Kansans wait for the results of the court challenge to the gerrymandered congressional map, there's another lawsuit in the making, if the supporters can raise enough money for the lawyers and expert testimony. That's the apparent gerrymandering of the State Board of Education districts. In the contested congressional map, Wyandotte County got split into two districts, apparently in an attempt to defeat Representative Sharice Davids. The State Board of Education map is even worse. It divides Wyandotte County into three different districts. Hank Chamberlain, a local activist, says he guesses Senate President Ty Masterson wants to get rid of all the current members of the board, who are 6 Republicans and 4 Democrats. And all, he says, are experienced educators who believe in public education, don't always agree, but work to find compromise and are not interested in made-up issues like critical race theory. Chamberlain predicts that with this re-engineered map, at least 8 of the 10 incumbents will be gone within 2 years. Chamberlain is lining up school boards and civic-minded people and organizations to file a suit alleging that the map violates the guidelines for redistricting. It won't happen unless he gets financial support. For more information, contact him at henrychamberlain330@gmail.com. And call us at the station for an address for checks. That's the news from our site. The news tonight was read by Stephen Hill, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. The Heartland Labor Forum was founded in 1989. One of our original programmers and engineers was Jack Hedrick, vice president of UAW Local 249 at the Ford Clay Como plant. At that time, the plant produced the Ford Tempo, a popular and affordable car. The plant had 2 sister plants producing the Tempo. One was in Oakville, Ontario, Canada, and the other was outside Mexico City in Cuautitlán Izcalli. I first heard about the Mexican plant from Jack, who told us about the murder of a Ford worker named Clito Nigmo in January 1990 inside the plant. In fact, in 1991, Jack joined a group of Ford workers, mostly from the Twin Cities Ford plant, to protest the killing in solidarity outside the Mexican plant. They demanded justice for the victims and supported the workers' struggle. Jack even made a film about it. With that attack died the strongest organization for independent unionism, free from the growing corporatism that has since characterized Mexican unions. The Ford Workers Democratic Movement, or FWDM, setting back effective unions to resist globalization until today. Who were the attackers? Who funded them? And why was there never a real investigation? Has been a mystery ever since. It's bothered me. It outraged Jack, who sadly died in 2013 at age 66. It also bothered our guest for tonight's show, Rob McKenzie. Rob worked at the Twin Cities Ford plant, and in 1998, he became the local president. After he retired, his curiosity led him on a multi-year hunt to find the answers to these questions, long buried in the memories of the Mexican workers and the records of the corrupt union, the CTM that represented them. The records were also buried in U.S. State Department files and those of the CIA. And despite Rob's persistent efforts, they are still buried in the AFL-CIO archives. Rob ended up writing a book along with a British history graduate named Patrick Dunn called El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico. And by the way, golpe means coup. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Well, thanks for having me, Judy. And I'd like to start off by thanking you for your help with my project. You were able to put me in touch with some of the leaders of this dissident movement in Mexico, and that led to interviews and really made it possible to do a book-length story about this. So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. I'm so happy to see this come to light after all these years. I did a lot of labor activism during the 90s in Mexico, and that's how I had those contacts. So you started out to investigate the attack on the Ford Mexico workers in 1990, but you and Patrick Dunn ended up writing a history of AFL-CIO foreign policy since World War II, mostly in Latin America. Can you give us a brief overview of what the book covers and why you had to go back that far to be able to explain what happened in 1990 in Mexico?
In 1996, I was at a meeting for the Coalition for Justice in the Maquiladoras, and you were there too.
Yeah.
At the conclusion of that meeting, a staff rep for the newly elected president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, came up to me and told me that the Sweeney administration believed that AFEL, or the American Institute for Free Labor Development, had been involved in the events at Cuautitlan. And I asked, well, aren't they related to the CIA? And he nodded his head. So over the years, I heard from several other good sources that Affeld had been involved there. And so when I retired, I just started to start researching that. And I was starting out just looking at a short paper. I hoped to find documents that would link Affeld to the events at Quetitlin. But then I left the question, what was Affeld? When I started, I had assumed that there was an authoritative source linking Affeld to the CIA and to the AFL-CIO and documenting what it was. But as I began to research this, I realized that wasn't true. So I was going to have to try and find out what Affeld was by my own efforts. And one way to do this was look at some of these Latin American coups and overthrows that had taken place that there was documented evidence. I mean, there are academics in the fields of Latin American history and sociology who have looked at this, though it's been really not covered by U.S. labor historians. So as I accumulated that, I needed to document what happened in these coups, what Affeld did. And I think we did that. And that was led to the first part of the book. We looked at British Guiana, Brazil, and Chile. I met Patrick Dunn, who was researching Chile for his undergraduate dissertation at Cambridge, and had written a paper about Affeld in Chile. So that is what much of Chapter 3 is about. And also El Salvador. There were a lot of journalists who were on what happened in El Salvador and documented a lot of Affeld activities. So that's why I took this deep dive into Latin American history. And as part of that, I also saw what was labor doing. I mean, it seemed hard for me to believe that labor had turned its back on this issue of collaboration with the CIA. And of course, labor hadn't. There was always a debate, always confrontation, always discord about this relationship with the AFL-CIO. So I also tried to document that and honor the labor people who tried to fight this battle about AFL-CIO and CIA collaboration.
The so-called free labor institutes, there was one for Latin America, that was Affeld. There was one for Asia, there was one for Africa, and there was one that covered Europe and sort of general stuff. And all of them were funded by the State Department and the CIA, correct?
Yeah, Affeld was 98% government funded. There was some, I would say, window dressing donations from the AFL-CIO and from some businesses. 98%, though, came from the government.
But Affeld and the others were actually institutions of the AFL-CIO.
Well, that's not what I believe. That's not what I believe. So the history of that was the birthplace of Affeld was in a group called the Labor Advisory Committee. And that had been set up in 1962 under the Kennedy administration. And that was based on a study and a paper written in the Eisenhower administration that said the government needed to coordinate its efforts in the Cold War on labor. And that they needed to coordinate it between the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and the U.S. Information Agency. So the heads of all those groups formed this Labor Advisory Committee. And so you had, I think the Defense Secretary was McNamara, Rusk at State, McCone was CIA. These are some heavy hitters. And they were joined at their second meeting by George Meany of the AFL-CIO. And accompanying him were two of his aides, or two Affeld aides, Serafino Rimaldi and Bill Doherty, who were both CIA agents. I don't know if Meany knew that or not. That's still somewhat of a question. But Meany came away from this meeting thinking he was in charge of this operation. In his archives, he talks about it as his labor advisory committee. Anyway, they funded Affeld with $350,000 at that second meeting and started it at that time. So after 3 years, it took me to get to this, but I believe that Affeld was a government-created agency managed by the CIA, for which the AFL-CIO provided cover throughout the Cold War.
I had a friend who was a union leader in Peru in the 1980s and 90s. He called the AFL the AFL-CIA. He said it was widely understood in Latin America that if you dealt with Affeld, you were dealing with the CIA, and that whatever information you may have given them about your union would become intelligence And the labor attachés typically in U.S. embassies in Latin America were funneling information to the CIA. Why is it that the CIA and the State Department saw it useful for their foreign operations to be in partnership with labor organizations of the United States, with the AFL-CIO, or at least to have cover of the AFL-CIO? Why were they so interested in labor's contacts abroad?
In the Cold War, which was cold sometimes, hot sometimes during our lifetime, the Soviet Union presented itself as a workers' government for justice for workers, ending exploitation for workers, and they promoted this message overseas. And to combat that, the U.S. felt they needed to fight in that arena and contest what they said about workers and labor with their own organization. Now, if your listeners want to see somebody talk about this, there is an excellent documentary on YouTube called On Company Business that was originally broadcast on PBS in 1980, and they interview Phil Agee, who was a CIA agent for 12 years and received labor training at the CIA so he could work in labor. He talks about the importance of labor in the Cold War. They really needed AFL. It was a critical, critical organization for them in the Cold War. And they needed AFL-CIO cover for that.
And I think the upshot of it in many countries, and this is what my friend from Peru confirmed, was that the kinds of unions that AFL supported and gave money to were sort of the Christian democratic unions as opposed to the left-wing unions. This was part of the battle against communism, except that these left-wing unions were often the ones that fought for democracy in their countries. My friend in Peru was an example of that. He led a labor plot, I guess you could call it, to overthrow a military dictatorship in Peru in the late 70s. And, you know, the more compliant unions that the AFL-CIO was supporting never would have done that. And so what we have was militant labor unions that really fought for the working class being spied on, while the more cooperative with management, cooperative with corporations, unions were getting the support of the U.S. government.
Yeah, and I think that's what our research shows. I mean, Patrick, in his part on Chile, goes into that in some depth.
Yeah, that chapter on Chile is terrific. Yeah. It really is. So moving along, the focus of your book is mostly on AFL, who, by the way, by 1967 had a yearly budget of $6 million, which was three times that of the AFL-CIO. So how do you know these people were CIA? You mentioned Phil Agee, but Bill Daugherty, who was AFL's executive director, said, quote, and this is from the book, "I repeat for the record that there has never been any involvement between AFL and the CIA. He then said, and as I would always do, and George Meany, vigorously denied that the CIA ever had anything to do with AFL, I would be willing to swear on a Bible, and I'm a practicing Catholic, that the CIA did not finance the AFL. But that doesn't do any good, because even if they did, I would have to deny it." Great quote.
He was pretty honest. That interview was done in 1996, and they told him it wouldn't be published for 20 years. That was published in 2018. So he got pretty close to telling the truth there. Listen, don't ask me about the CIA. I can't tell you. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I really looked into, too, was who was William C. Daugherty, Jr., because he was the executive director for 30 years. And there's no question in my mind he was a career CIA agent. So, I mean, Agee, in his book, Inside the Company, explicitly says that. He says he worked with Daugherty on a project, a CIA project in Ecuador in 1960. And I didn't find anybody discrediting what he said in that book. So to me, if you want to say that Daugherty wasn't CIA, you need to start there. But I also researched his whole life and his whole career from the time he graduated in college. And there's no question he was a career CIA agent.
Okay. We're talking to Rob McKenzie, the author of the book, El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the coup at Ford in Mexico. So why do you think the AFL-CIO allowed this to happen? Why did they allow their folks and their name to be used in this way?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure I have the complete answer of that. Certainly, it involved George Meany and his life. I mean, he dropped out of high school at the age of 16 and took a plumber's apprenticeship, and at 21 became a full-time union official, and then did that kind of work until he was 86.
And I remember he also said he was proud that he had never been on strike.
Yes, I've never been part of an organization that went on strike. So, you know, he is quite a character. And, you know, how much hatred he had for communism was really hard to understand from what I found about his life. There must have been conflicts with communists maybe when he was in his early years. He was a conservative Catholic. It might just have been an ideological thing. But he seemed to really focus his life's work on fighting communism from what I've seen. So you have him, and then there was another group of very conservative union officials who were also involved in one way or another with the CIA. So that would include William C. Doherty Jr.'s father, William C. Doherty Sr., David Dubensky of the Garment Workers Union was another one. There was a group of them that were right in step with Meany. But generally, I don't think these things went to the executive council and were thoroughly discussed there. One of the things I would really like to get, which I can't get, is the UAW had transcripts at this time. That was a 1966 AFL-CIO executive council meeting where a guy named Joe Bierney, who also AG identified as a CIA collaborator, made a motion to condemn Victor Reuther when he went public with his accusation that AFLD was a CIA group and the AFL-CIO was giving a cover. So they passed a motion condemning Victor Reuther at that meeting. I would like to see a transcript of that meeting and what was said. It exists. It's just closed, locked up in George Meany Memorial Archives. I can't get it. I don't know that anybody ever has, but it is.
Yeah, a number of people have tried.
Yeah.
You mentioned Joe. Is that how you said his name, Bierney?
Yes.
He was president of CWA at the time.
He was.
Right. The most famous dissident from this whole thing was Victor Reuther, and then, of course, his brother, Walter Reuther. And one of the intriguing things you have in the book here is you cast doubt on the death of Walter Reuther and his wife in a plane crash. You say it may not have been an accident. Why do you think that?
I thought I knew a lot about UAW history when I started this.
Yeah, after all, you were a UAW local president.
Yeah, for a long time, and an activist and an international staff rep for the UAW. I started out tracing this debate, which I found in the CIA declassified files between Victor and a lot of people on AFL. And how did that debate end? It ended with the crash in Pellston, Michigan. And I don't see how anybody can look at this and not say it was assassination. It was the third problem they'd had, the second crash, and the third problem they'd had with an altimeter. The NTSB did a wonderful analysis of the crash, and it was caused, one, by there's lights on a runway, and this was at night in the rain they were coming in, that tell a pilot what their altitude is and their angle. Those lights were shut off because a light had broken. They were switched to another runway that didn't have those lights. They had to rely on the altimeter. The altimeter had seven defects, major defects, that made it read. The NTSB said it was reading 200, 250 feet higher than the plane actually was. Now, you think, well, the manufacturer of that altimeter is going to be in trouble. They washed their hands of it. They said, we made this altimeter for the military. It was never sanctioned for use in private aviation, and they were not held responsible. Now, what I believe happened is the NTSB turned, they just said this is what caused it, not seeing the lights and the altimeter. They turned it over to the FBI. A TV reporter for a Detroit station named Bill Gallagher did a Freedom of Information Act request on the FBI and the Reuthers. And he got hundreds of pages, but thousands of pages were withheld, including 200 pages the FBI had on the crash that were held on the basis of national security.
Wow.
So Gallagher turned his material over to the Reuther Archives, and it's there what he got. But no one has ever challenged that national security exemption on the FBI documents, which I'm trying to do, but it's a slow process.
This is your next book, huh?
That's my next effort, if I okay. ever make it that far, yes.
Okay, but I want to get to Mexico, and we're going to take a break. We're talking to Rob McKenzie, author of El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico, and we'll be back after a few announcements.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area, every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
KKFI is accepting applications for a full-time Director of Development and Communications. As part of the Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For a list of job responsibilities, required qualifications, salary range, and the application process, go to kkfi.org/employment.
We're back. I'm Judy Ansel. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and I'm talking to Rob McKenzie about his book about the coup against the Ford workers in Mexico in 1990. This was just before NAFTA. NAFTA passed in 1993, and already starting in the late 80s, the ground was being prepared both in the U.S. and Mexico and also Canada for the passage of NAFTA. But before we get to that, who were the players, both in the U.S. Embassy at that time and in AFIELD in Mexico? I know AFIELD had a big operation in Mexico. And what was the labor situation leading up to this event?
Mexico was in economic and political turmoil during the 80s. So the economic turmoil started with the depression in the early 80s, the collapse of oil prices, which Mexico had relied on heavily, resulting in cuts to social spending and stopping infrastructure projects, devaluing the peso, which resulted in hyperinflation. And in 1985, a major earthquake hit Mexico City, and hundreds of buildings toppled, a couple hundred thousand people were homeless, and the government really botched the relief effort. And that resulted in a bunch of self-help groups getting active politically. A leftist group around the University of Mexico, the National Mexico University, getting active and also winning a lot of support. And those things all culminated in 1988 when one of the leaders of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which had ruled Mexico for 65 years, broke off, criticized a lot of the free market, hyper-competitive, free trade policies the government was moving to, and ran for president, Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas.
Cuauhtemoc Cárdenas.
Thank you for pronouncing that correctly. Thank you. There's probably people listening who would know that. There's not much dispute that was a fraudulent election, a massive fraud.
I was in Mexico in 1988 in the summer, right after the elections.
Yeah.
And I was staying with a family that was from his state in Mexico. And I remember the family was just irate that the election had been stolen. Yeah. And they said they could prove it, and that there was so much vote tampering, but Carlos Salinas got away with it, and he became the new president.
Yeah, and he had a lot of support in the U.S.
He was U.S. educated.
Yeah, he was at Harvard. I think he got a degree in Harvard, and the CIA had been telling the Reagan administration, don't worry about Mexico. This is a very stable country. Nothing's going to happen. Well, at this point, they had a lot of egg in their face, and they took quick action. A new diplomatic team was sent to Mexico as soon as the election results were validated by a 10-vote margin in the lower house of the Mexican Congress. The new ambassador would be John D. Negroponte. He'd been in Honduras before this. His role there had been to get the Honduran government to support the Contras in their war against the Nicaraguan government, and then in turn get aid for Honduras. Now, that was illegal. The Congress had passed an amendment prohibiting that. So that went on, but the Washington Post accused Negroponte of using back-channel communications to keep the State Department informed about what he was doing. So he was sent as ambassador. The deputy chief of mission in Honduras at the time was a guy named Robert Pastorino, who'd been Reagan's Latin American security person on the National Security Council. He went as deputy chief of mission, and the CIA station chief in Honduras, Vincent Shields, also went to Mexico all at the same time. Now, what was interesting to me about this group is that Pastorino wrote the first conceptual draft of NAFTA in Mexico. And in later interviews, Negroponte said his greatest achievement there was facilitating negotiations for NAFTA between Bush and Salinas. So, I also suspect that the CIA then was the force that was involved in Cuautitlan. And that's pretty circumstantial just to who the diplomatic team was, but it says something about what was going on in Mexico at the time.
Well, it was interesting to me that in the book, you have a lot of communiques between Negroponte and the State Department and the CIA reporting on what is going on at this Ford factory. I don't know how common it is for a U.S. ambassador to send regular reports about one particular factory in a foreign country, but it seemed a little unusual to me.
Yeah, I had 11 cables, which I got through a Freedom of Information Act request, which I had a lot of difficulty with that too. And had it not been for U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, I don't think I would have ever got him, because they're very revealing about how important this labor struggle at Ford Cuautitlan was and how much collusion there was between the Mexican government, the CTM, and really the U.S. in resolving this in a way that they wanted it to go.
And yeah. So this was an administration that not only stole the election, but then contributed mightily to the whole spread of narco trafficking in Mexico into the United States. Yeah. And these are the guys who brought us NAFTA from the Mexican side. So now let me ask you, U.S. labor was very much opposed to NAFTA. By the time Clinton got to be president, he had to figure out how to pass NAFTA mainly with Republican votes because the Democrats opposed it. But in Mexico, it's a little different story. The unions in Mexico actually supported it, didn't they?
Yeah, the CTM did. I suppose all the government allowed unions did support it.
Yeah, and CTM is the largest labor union in Mexico. It's really dominant.
And it's a part of the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, constituent part. So it's really a government union all the time that the PRA is in power.
Which is really ironic to me because, the American Institute for Free Labor Development supported independent unions around the world that were not dominated by governments. And here they are majorly supporting the CTM, which is completely dominated by the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which has ruled Mexico for decades.
That's very ironic, as is it that the AFLD itself was a government agency, in my view.
Yeah. Right. Okay, go on. Give us an overview of the worker organizing for Foreign Democratic Workers Movement. There was a strike in 1987, which I think leads to the push for a independent union, independent of the CTM. So can you take us through that?
Yeah, in 1987, as I talked a little bit earlier, major economic problems in Mexico, and the Cuautitlan plant was producing vehicles for the domestic market in Mexico, and sales were terrible. They had a bunch of extra workers. They needed to do a layoff in 87. So this is the solution Ford and the CTM came up with, that Ford, the government was recommending a 27% wage increase that year. Ford would not agree to that. The CTM would call a strike. But during the strike, Ford paid half the wages of the workers. So in fact, it was a subsidized layoff with one major problem. Under Mexican labor law, after 3 months strike, then the employer could terminate the contract, which after 4 months, Ford terminated the contract and it since fired everybody. So the government said, well, you've got to get a new contract approved before you can bring these people back. You can't just install your own contract. So they got a contract passed. People didn't know the details. They'd been out of work or half work for 4 or 5 months. No, it was like almost 6 months. It went through the summer. So people were pretty desperate to get back to work. Well, when that contract was approved, it turned out that the CTM and Ford had agreed to a two-tier wage scale years earlier, and that was in this contract. So they're all rehired as this second tier. So it amounted to a 40% wage cut. And 600 people were never recalled. They got rid of all the people they wanted to get rid of. You can imagine that, not a happy group of workers there. And there were people who had opposed the strike and who had opposed ratification. And most of them were involved with a group called the Revolutionary Workers Party, who had been opposed to the Institutional Revolutionary Party and had been very active and successful in organizing in the plant. And by the time this contract rolled around, them or their supporters were in control of the local union and were really doing a lot of good things with the local union. I mean, they were having regular union meetings and grievances, and people were listening to the workers. Not usual in Mexico. And they gained a reputation for this throughout Mexico.
We're talking to Rob McKenzie, the author of the book, once again, El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the coup at Ford in Mexico. Is this why this affiliation with a leftist union, do you think this is why AFIELD and the U.S. embassy were so interested in making sure that these workers didn't prevail?
Absolutely. And I think that's what set the CIA off. They were not going to. So I'll get to the story, what they had to do. Try to do it quick.
Okay.
There was going to be an election in 89 against the head of the CTM Ford unit. The Cuautitlan local was going to run people, and they were going to win. It looked like they had the votes to easily win that. Ford fired four of the six local executive committee people, and that's when they formed the Ford Workers Democratic Movement and then took the struggle to a whole nother level in that summer of 89.
The struggle progresses.
Well, we have to go to January 5th. This took me a while to figure out what had happened. On January 5th, the leaders, most of them who'd been fired, came to the plant to hand out a leaflet to call on the workers to come to a meeting with the head of the CTM, Fidel Velasquez, on the 8th.
Fidel Velasquez? Fidel had been, I think, appointed the head of the CTM in 1939. He was basically an Institutional Revolutionary Party functionary running the largest labor union in Mexico. And his concerns were simply not the concerns of a rank-and-file Ford worker. For sure.
So the leaders came to the plant to hand out this leaflet on Friday, the 5th of January. They were kidnapped by a bunch of goons, golpeadores, who had kidnapped them. And now in the interviews, they said they thought they were going to be murdered. And I think that's probably true. They'd already fired them, beaten them, threatened to kill them. There wasn't much left for them to do with these guys. But when the workers in the plant heard about the disappearances, they went on a sit-down strike and stopped work and refused to go back to work until their leaders were released. And they were released that same day, Friday the 5th. So everybody went home for the weekend, and they returned to work on Monday, January 8th, expecting trouble. They had got some notification Sunday night that there were strange people entering the plant. So that early morning before the shift started, around 300 golpeadores entered the Ford plant. It was five separate buildings on the Ford facility there. They sent a group to each plant. They were wearing Ford jackets. They had Ford IDs. They had been brought together in the middle of the night. None of them had cars. They had walkie-talkies to communicate among themselves. Some of them had submachine guns. Some of them had firearms. And they went into the plant. Now, why they went in, and this is something I found in research, Ford had planned on firing the leaders of the January 5th work stoppage that morning, Monday morning. These golpeadores came in.
A golpeador is literally a beater. In other words, some kind of thug who beats people up.
Yeah, and usually they got a purpose for it, some kind of major purpose there.
That's like a hired thug.
They'd come into the plant to stop another work stoppage. The workers were prepared for him and confronted him, picked up tools and confronted him and started to drive him out of the plant. At that point, they pulled out their firearms and shot nine people, one of them who died. But once they started shooting, they knew eventually the police would get there, even though they were already there, because Ford had called them in to remove some of the fired workers, but they fled. And the workers then, for their own safety and to advance their demands, occupied the plant. And, they demanded rehiring the fired people, straightening out pay shortages, no more attacks, guarantee the safety of people. And they called for a National Democratic Congress on labor rights in Mexico, which I think is really important because they saw what the problem was. And they occupied the plant for 2 weeks before they were forced out by 2,000 police.
What makes you think that this incident had anything to do with Afield, Negroponte, the CIA, or the AFL-CIO.
I always felt the CTM, this was beyond their capacities. This was a paramilitary operation. But more than that, 2 days after this happened, the head of the Auto Workers Federation, include all the auto plant unions of the CTM, held a press conference and demanded an investigation of Wallace de la Mancha, a gangster who the newspapers reported had been heading up this attack. No way that happens if the CTM as an organization is behind this. More than that, the CTM sent somebody to Congress and got up in front of the lower house in Congress and denied CTM involvement in this at all. He said there's mysterious forces out there that do this kind of thing. So I don't think that it was a CTM. Definitely people in the CTM were involved. Hector Urarte was involved.
He was the head of the local union.
He was head of the Ford CTM, so included the two new Ford plants on the northern border and the Mexico City plant. Mm-hmm. So I found a document which shows Hector Urarte and two other Mexican labor leaders on a private jet flight from Washington, D.C. to San Diego. The other passengers on the flight are Tom Donahue, the Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO, Owen Bieber, who is the president of the UAW, William C. Doherty Jr., who I've talked about, and two staff people. One of them was Mark Anderson, and the other was Steve Beckman. Both Anderson and Beckman gave me long phone interviews. They both adamantly denied they had any kind of meetings with Mexicans at Washington, D.C. at this time. And Bieber and Donahue couldn't have met with them without their staff people there. That's just how dependent they are on their staff people. That leaves one guy in this flight who was meeting with them. That's William C. Doherty, who I'm 100% sure was a CIA agent. I believe the CIA was meeting with Urarte and two other Mexican labor leaders. And that's November of 88, 2 weeks after the election was ratified. And almost as soon as Urarte gets back, then things start happening at the Ford plant, too.
What is the connection with NAFTA? I know you say in the book that the CTM was interested basically in holding down wages and maintaining its control over Mexican workers so that the Mexico would not lose foreign investment. And, you know, I started doing solidarity work in Mexico about 1993, right about the same time as NAFTA passed. I understood why Mexican workers wanted independent unions, just like the Ford workers did. I became involved in labor struggles for independent unions all along the border from Tijuana to Matamoros. Nobody won. Not one independent union was able to prevail. The way I see this is the defeat of the independent union at Ford in 1990 was a harbinger of how Mexico and probably with the help of the U.S. government was going to make sure that Mexican workers had no freedom of association to be able to raise their wages, because the whole deal with NAFTA was dependent on, you know, exporting capital and getting cheap imports by paying wages of hunger. And to me, the, you know, like the results of the Cuautitlan struggle, we've been paying for three decades. And, you know, just now we're beginning to see the emergence of a few independent unions in Mexico. Is that how you see it? Or, you know, do you have a different take?
No, very much so. I mean, the left labor groups were opposed to NAFTA. They thought it gave too much control of the economy to foreign corporations.
Uh-huh.
And were very much opposed to it. But they were, during those late 80s, were broken and defeated. And a result of this is a NAFTA. There was very little opposition left to it by the time they imposed it.
So what hope do you see today?
I actually see a lot of hope. One of the early researchers I'm involved with sent me an email and said he'd just been at a weekend conference where they formed a new auto workers federation, an independent union. Well, I thought that sounds good. Well, that was Cintia, who was able to win an election at the GM Silao plant and also won at a parts place in Matamoros. So those are seismic shifts in Mexican labor. I think that you have to say some of the forces that were aligned against these dissidents in Mexico City, number one was the government. It was a corrupt government that had lost an election. Well, you know, López Obrador is pretty supportive of independent unions. And the U.S. government, I believe, was very much opposed to those dissidents. And they're actually supporting now an independent union. I think the Biden administration has come to the view that this huge pool of super cheap labor on the border is destabilizing in the U.S., which it is.
Well, of course, it's helped create our immigration crisis. Finally, you know, you could write a whole book about just trying to uncover this and your search and your use of freedom of information, and you're finding, you know, files empty in archives that should be full and all of that kind of stuff. What's missing? What still needs to be done?
I think international worker solidarity is critical if labor is going to survive, if U.S. labor is going to survive. That needs to become a core value. That can't happen unless we're able to confront this dark past. And for that to happen, the archives need to be opened up. They are closed. They're closed on all these institutes, AFELD and the other institutes. The International Affairs Department files are closed. And there's probably more information there because you had, you know, honest staff people writing reports about things. That really needs to happen. That is something that is totally in the ability of the AFL-CIO, the UAW. I know they have files that are closed to researchers and members. Those need to be opened. And, you know, the membership has a voice in this. If you want to make a resolution or turn one into a recording secretary, that will help get these files open so we can put this past behind us and move forward.
Thank you so much, Rob McKenzie.
Well, thanks for having me, Judy.
And the book, once again, is El Golpe, U.S. Labor, the CIA, and the Coup at Ford in Mexico, by Rob McKenzie with Patrick Dunn, and it's published by Pluto Press.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Know Your Rights. This is Mike Amash with the law firm of Blake & Ulig. This month on Know Your Rights, we're going to discuss captive audience meetings. As any union organizer or any individual involved in a union organizing campaign will tell you, one of the most commonly utilized tools in an employer's tool belt to resist a union organizing campaign is the captive audience meeting. So what is a captive audience meeting? Captive audience meeting occurs when an employer gives speeches that discourage workers from joining a union or that are in some way anti-union. These speeches may be given to employees on company time and company property and are not supposed to be coercive in nature. The employer is not required to give the union equal opportunity to reply to the speech during work hours or on company property. And the only exception to the general rule regarding captive audience speeches and an employer's ability to engage in captive audience speeches is that they are barred in the 24-hour, quote, cooling off period immediately preceding an NLRB representation election. The genesis of the captive audience meeting comes from the 1947 amendments to the National Labor Relations Act. In 1947, Congress amended the act to include Section 8C, which is titled Expressions of Views Without Threat of Reprisal or Force or Promise of Benefit. It states, the expressing of any views, arguments, or opinion, or the dissemination thereof, whether in written, printed, graphic, or visual form, shall not constitute or be evidence of an unfair labor practice under any provisions of the Act, if such expressions contain no threat of reprisal or force or promise of benefit. That last sentence is important. If such expression contains no threat of reprisal or force or promise of benefit. In 1948, a year after Section 8C was added to the Act, the National Labor Relations Board gave life to Section 8C in a case called Babcock and Wilcox. In that case, the Labor Board held that an employer did not violate the Act when it compelled its employees during work to attend and listen to a speech that encouraged the employees to reject the union. The Babcock and Wilcox case allowed for the unfettered proliferation of captive audience meetings, which we see to this day, and employers throughout the years have gotten increasingly aggressive in the use of captive audience meetings. Many of you listening have likely been in a meeting during a union organizing campaign where a supervisor or manager reads from a carefully prepared script about what may or might happen if the employees choose to form and organize a union. Or instead of a supervisor or manager, you may have been in a meeting where the company's paid union buster tells you what may or might happen and what they've seen other places and scare people who are trying to organize or involved in the organizing campaign in their workplace. They're careful not to make any direct promises of benefits or make any direct threats to employees. But employees get the idea. They understand what's being implied. The current general counsel to the National Labor Relations Board, in recent filings to the board, is encouraging a shift in the law related to captive audience meetings, a shift to more further protect employees who do not want to attend these captive audience meetings and want to exercise their rights to refrain from being required or implicitly required to attend such meetings. The general counsel has urged the board to overrule Babcock and Wilcox and hold that as a matter of law, reasonable employees will perceive an implicit, if not explicit, threat of reprisal for exercising their right to refrain from listening to their employer's captive audience speech related to their union organizing activity in two circumstances. First, when those meetings are convened on paid time, and second, when an employee is cornered while performing their job duties. In both cases, the general counsel argues, they constitute a captive audience speech where employees are compelled to listen by a threat of discipline, discharge, or other reprisal, whether that threat be implicit or explicit. We'll look forward to the NLRB's decision in that case. But until then, this has been Know Your Rights with Mike Amash.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 21st. And you can find our calendar on our Facebook page. Just look for Heartland Labor Forum on Facebook. The new Kansas chapter of Alliance for Retired Americans is meeting on Zoom tomorrow, Friday at 11 a.m. In order to get a contact, email mdunn@retiredamericans.org. Town Hall. What's coming up in the Kansas veto session? State Rep Stephanie Clayton, Jerry Stodgill, Jared Owsley, and Rui Hsu, and Melanie Haas from the State Board of Education. Saturday, 9 a.m., Sylvester Powell Community Center, 6200 Martway in Mission. And the UU Forum this Sunday, Sissyphobia with Richard Thompson. Why does our society have so much difficulty dealing with effeminate men? That's at 10 a.m. Sunday. For a link, go to allsoulskc.org. And finally, Heartland Alliance for Progress, Jackson County Candidate Forum, Monday, April 25th, 6 p.m. on Zoom. And there's a registration link. You have to go to our Facebook page to find it. And then Tuesday, we did this on the news, Starbucks sip-in for the baristas from 10 to 4 at Starbucks, 18710 East 39th Street, across from Independence Mall. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. The show is going to be a centennial of the railway shopman strike in 1922 and rail negotiations. Rich carriers, exploited workers. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Marissa Butler. Yay, Marissa. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Stand Up, produced by the Racial Justice Initiative.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum, KKFI, at gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.